From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 46 of Little Brother, dated the 7th of August, 2021. Stay tuned, Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everybody that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. So let's get started. In June of this year, video game publisher Electronic Arts fell victim to a ransomware attack. In such attacks, cybercriminals take control of their victims' computer systems, encrypt all of the content, and then demand the payment of a ransom in exchange for a key that will decrypt the systems. As is often the case, the attackers collected a large tranche of data from the victim's systems, which can be released to the internet in the event that the ransom is not paid. EA's data were released between July 14th and 26th, including over 780 gigabytes of source code. The data are now widely available via BitTorrent. EA are actively working with law enforcement to investigate. While we're on the topic of ransomware, it seems that Taiwanese PC hardware maker Gigabyte has been gigabit now. The attack on Wednesday forced them to shut down their systems, and the attackers are believed to have exfiltrated 112 gigabytes of data. The attackers allege that a large part of the data is under non-disclosure agreements that Gigabyte has with other companies, including both Intel and AMD, and that they are ready to publish it. In 2019, the Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs researched the state of cybersecurity in the federal government, inspecting the measures taken by eight key departments, including DHS, HUD, State Department, and the Social Security Administration, and released a report giving them all poor grades. This month, the same committee published their two-year follow-up report, and things haven't improved much. Of the eight agencies, only DHS made significant improvements. Keep in mind that this is happening in a world with an increasingly hostile environment, both politically and, as this episode's headlines are clearly already showing, technologically. Federal agencies are rife with unpatched critical vulnerabilities and shadow IT operations, making it not just a juicy target for cybercriminals, but also an easy one. However, even as the federal government's cybersecurity is awful, the same federal government is imposing new regulations on companies that operate critical infrastructure. This idea has been in circulation for around 20 years. However, this year's attack on the Colonial Pipeline seems to have persuaded the Transportation Security Administration to issue regulations requiring operators of critical pipelines to implement a number of urgently needed protections against cyber intrusions. The list of requirements includes development of contingency and recovery plans, figuring out where the gaps and vulnerabilities are and getting them fixed, appointing a cyber coordinator who is available to DHS officials 24/7, and reporting intrusions within 12 hours. The Transportation Security Administration is a division of the Department of Homeland Security, which, as I mentioned a moment ago, are the only federal agency to have improved their own cybersecurity footing. The COVID pandemic has triggered a sort of all-hands-on-deck response from industry and researchers, as well it should. One of the sectors involved is the machine learning and artificial intelligence sector. AI models work by training the model on data for which the expected outcome is known. For instance, the AI can be shown things of a number of various colors, and then those colors can be associated with names such as red, green, blue, etc., and the AI looks for common patterns and learns. This is then used to classify things. The problem is, AI doesn't always match on the right pattern. It turns out that the AIs that were trained on COVID data latched onto, of all things, the font used by some hospitals with higher COVID caseloads as an indicator of COVID infection. Security researcher Richard Henderson presented at DEF CON this week about a denial-of-service attack that's easily carried out against barcode reading systems that run on Windows or have Windows as a back end. The attack takes advantage of three things: a supposedly harmless string of text, commonly known as the ICAR string, which is used to test antivirus software, the presence of antivirus software on systems running Windows, and the ability of pretty much anyone with a computer to produce a barcode or a QR code or similar. The attack is very simple. Put the test string into a barcode and scan it on the system you intend to attack. The antivirus software detects the string and quarantines the file containing it, potentially breaking the database or doing other damage to the system. It has been tested against a number of systems, including passport kiosks at border crossings, point-of-sale terminals, and parking garage gates. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. Doctor Who fans may recall some years ago when Jack Harkness joined the Doctor's entourage and he asked a pointed question of the Doctor. Who looks at a screwdriver and thinks, ooh, this could be just a little more sonic? We need to take a look at things like this. Who looks at things already working and thinks, ooh, this could be just a little more online? Well, whoever it is, that's who brought us the Internet of Broken Things. For some of these things, your typical smart home appliances, the washing machine that connects to the Wi-Fi for no functional reason, the thermostat that you can turn up or down from halfway around the world using your smartphone, and your TV that bypasses the old cable TV model by streaming TV over the internet, the cost of a failure or a hiccup is pretty low. Maybe your house is too hot or too cold, or you can't catch the latest episode of Doctor Who. Whatever. These are inconveniences. But what if the system is something critical? Many hospitals are equipped with pneumatic tube systems and have been for a long time. Things can be quickly shuttled from place to place in the building or even between buildings by placing them into canisters that can be carried through a tube on a blast of air. This isn't new technology by any stretch of the imagination, nor is it revolutionary. 20th century systems would have had all of the tubes end in the mailroom where someone can take it and move it to a different tube to get it routed to the right place. As technology has advanced, these systems have become more mechanized and automated so that no human intervention is needed. When sending something, a number can be dialed indicating where it's going, and the machinery will just take it there. From there, it evolved into something using a networked computer to control the system, and it went online. This is not entirely hypothetical. Dark Reading has recently recovered flaws in just such a system, the Swisslog Nexus control panel for pneumatic tube systems. The vulnerability has suitably been named Pwned Piper. And it opens the door to memory corruption and denial of services of critical systems, which, again, in a hospital setting, can be a literal life and death matter. Let me be clear. There is no need for these systems to connect to the internet. But before tackling that, let's talk about the maintenance that embedded systems get. It is, in a word, none. Systems that are installed as infrastructure rarely get the updates that they need. Either the updates are tied to expensive hardware upgrades or they require maintenance contracts which have run out and not been renewed, because why would they continue maintenance on a system that is working just fine? And let's not forget that sometimes software updates to the operating system or to the system firmware will break drivers or even make the hardware completely inaccessible. This is a problem in and of itself and a big part of the Internet of Broken Things. But the simplest solution to preventing the Internet of Broken Things from causing issues is, don't put them on the internet. It's a common practice here in my city, and probably many others, for residents to put things out on a garbage day that might not be collected by the city in the hopes that a scrapper will come along and make use of them. Now, to that end, I am a computer scrapper. I will happily take in computer or AV equipment and do my level best to upcycle it. One unfortunate thing that I have learned from doing this is that quite often people don't know how to safely dispose of a computer. Computers, even broken ones, have components inside that will remember what the owner used it for. Even as your computer is broken, outdated, or just plain won't boot because the software's been corrupted, the contents of the computer's durable memory, either its hard drive or its flash, remain partly or fully intact. I have one, for instance, that I'm rebuilding right now. The condition it was in when I picked it up, it was clear that it had been sitting in someone's basement for a bit, and it just would not boot. I found out that the hard drive was in bad shape to the point that it wasn't really able to be used for the system, but guess what? All of the documents and such that belonged to this computer's former owner were still in there. Bills, taxes, medical records, even a resume were all in there for me to see. One thing I have noticed is that people are not completely oblivious to this fact. A computer I picked up recently, when I opened it up and looked inside, I found that many of the cables had been slashed. Valiant attempt. Unfortunately, while that did make the computer as a whole not usable to me, it had an unusual sized power supply that I wasn't going to be able to source easily, they had completely failed in the most important objective. The hard drive was there, fully intact, with all of its data still in place. While I have erased it so that the drive can be reused, someone less honorable could have run away with that computer's former owner's data and possibly made a hash of their lives. The Center for Internet Security, yes, I get a lot of my stories from them, just this week published an advisory about this. Their advice, as mine, is to make sure that you physically destroy the hard drive or use a wiper program such as Activat Killdisk or Derek's Boot and Nuke, better known as DBAN, to erase your hard drive completely. Otherwise, you should bring your computer to a trusted refurbisher for proper and secure disposal. If you aren't sure of what you're doing, please find somebody you can trust who does. For the record, any hard drives I come across that are usable get erased completely and reused, and any that are not reusable get destroyed as I upcycle them into wind chimes. Speaking as an IT worker, one of the things that I've long thought appropriate is for the option to exist to work from home. The idea originally occurred to me when my employer at the time moved the location of my office from one city to another, tripling the distance of my commute and quadrupling the length of time it took to drive it. As I tried to reason with them for various options to compensate for this, such as a compressed work week or working from home some portion of the week, all of these fell on deaf ears. While this isn't true across the board, with many IT jobs and clerical jobs, call centers, and possibly a number of other areas I'm not thinking of, there is no real reason for the employees to be tied to a fixed workplace if they don't want to be. As a system administrator with decades of experience, there have only been maybe a year or two of my career where I've needed to be able to access and enter the data center, so location only really mattered for those brief periods of time. And there's the thing right there. If you don't need to be physically in contact with a resource, you should be able to be anywhere that the internet can reach you. It's truly a tragedy that the COVID-19 pandemic came along. But we would be foolish if we didn't take the lessons we learned from coping with it and adapt them going forward. One of those lessons has been that, yes, we can work from home. We can attend meetings on Zoom or Jitsi or Teams or Skype or Hangouts or WebEx, or even just a good old-fashioned conference call. The pandemic struck about a month after I started my current job. We were told to go home, and we would be told when it was safe to come back. In the meantime, my customer has actually closed the building where my office was located. I couldn't go back if I wanted to, and I couldn't be happier for it. What working from home for the past 18 months has brought me has been no commute, meaning no time wasted in transit, no wear and tear on my car, and I can literally go a month between refueling my car. I get more done because I don't have coworkers approaching me at my desk. Mind you, I don't mind the social interaction, but it does take you out of your flow. And since we're talking about working from home to avoid a pandemic, let me mention also that there was a prior time that I worked from home for approximately a year. During that year, I almost never got sick. Not even so much as a head cold, which normally happens to me about twice annually. Now, I don't advocate this for everyone. Some folks need the social interaction or the break from home. But if you have people working for you, please consider seriously the idea of letting them continue to work from home to the degree practicable. Don't feel that you need to monitor their every movement. Let their achievements speak for themselves. After all, that's what really matters. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fongaboo and the Crowded Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group, especially Azriel, for assistance with some of the stories. Music used in this episode was Adrenochrome by Super Action 80, and our theme music is Around Chaos by Heatseeker. Join us next week when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Stay safe and be well.